Okay, so today's topic, come in. First of all, welcome to the second day, and I don't know if it was said yesterday, but I also want to give a very big thanks, although he's not here, but to Rav Shua from Mizrahi for giving us the space to be able to do this with proper distancing and so on and so forth. Yeah. Just make sure everyone's spread out, please, so we can be properly distanced and so on. So today's topic is a very fascinating topic. A little bit of an introductory warning. There's some wild stuff that we're going to share with you today. It's a topic, like most of these topics, that you need a series, not just a shiur. But I'll share with you some highlights, because obviously, like everything, there's various different approaches in coming from different commentators, and coming from different sources, and so on and so forth. What I'm going to give you today is an approach taken by many, particularly the Kabbalists, the Mekubalim, particularly based on the Arizal or the other Kabbalists, the Mekubalim, that follow the sort of system of Arizal and Kabbalah in general. The topic is Gilgulim, the concept of reincarnation and how that works in Judaism. Normally, the concept of Gilgul is thought of as a Christian concept or a non-Jewish concept. But in fact, it is not. It is sourced in Jewish literature way, 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 way back. And it's a very Jewish concept. Now, the way it's in Jewish literature and in Jewish commentary is obviously very different than the way it is in non-Jewish one. And obviously what we're going to talk about today is part of the Jewish approach to the concept of Gilgul. So we do find, particularly in Kabbalah, particularly in the Arizal, we find the concept of Gilgul. We find the concept of an neshama, a soul, coming back to this world. Meaning souls are not only here once, but souls do come back, right? And the question is, why and what's the purpose and how does it happen and in what form does it happen and so on and so forth. So I'm going to divide what we talk about today in three parts. One part is sort of just to understand the origin, what is Gilgul and what's the purpose of Gilgul. Then I'm going to give you a couple of wild examples of where we find in Kabbalah about different Gilgulim, different reincarnations that we know about. Meaning, for most part, none of us know about. Like, we do know that the masters of Kabbalah, particularly in the last number of centuries, have told us that we are all Gilgulim, right? We're coming close to Mashiach now. We've all been here before. Who am I in the previous life? I don't know, and I don't really care. It's the truth, and we'll see at the end why I don't care, because not really that relevant. But nevertheless, we do find, particularly in the Arizal and in many other Kabbalah, we find examples of Gilgulim that took place, and some fascinating stuff just out of interest that come out of it, which I'll give you a couple of examples, and then towards the end hopefully we'll have time where we're going to actually go through the relevance of it. Otherwise, why is it relevant to know about Gilgul? Why is it a relevant topic altogether? Okay, so let's start with the first. So that's the three parts. The first thing is the origin. So let me just give you a very quick synopsis of the journey of the soul, so to speak, right? You can come in, you can sit over here in this front. Just please, just stay spread out if you don't mind. So, the Arizal tells us in Sefer HaGilgulim, in the book where he talks about Gilgul, that originally HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God created, if I just ask that everyone sits properly distance, if you don't mind, maybe sit over there. Leah may want to just move over a little bit, thanks. So originally the concept of a soul, and particularly we talk about the Jewish soul, but souls in general, were rooted in Adam HaRishon, the first man that was created. The Arizal tells us that Adam HaRishon had included within him, we know that God infused him with a soul. It says in the Chumash, "Vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim," God blew into the nostrils of Adam HaRishon a soul of life. But we have this concept in Kabbalah of 600,000 souls. Now, when we say there's 600,000 souls, it doesn't mean there are only 600,000 souls. What it means is there are 600,000 category souls. Head souls kind of thing, right? And they break down into many, many different souls, right? Because we have this magic number of 600,000, which we talk about the Jews in Egypt was 600,000. But of course, they weren't 600,000. They were, even the Jews in England, when they left Egypt, they weren't 600,000. They were more like 3 million, according to the calculation that we have, right? There were 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, yes. But there were many more people than 600,000. Of course, throughout the generations, there'd be many, many more not only recycled souls, but even just souls, new souls that are much more than 600,000, but they all rooted in the number 600,000. The 600,000 is categories of souls, so to speak. And the Arizal says that Adam HaRishon had within him all 600,000 souls. And in fact, they corresponded, the different souls corresponded to different parts of the body. There were souls connected to Adam Rishon's head, there were souls connected to his hands, to his feet, and so on and so forth, which on a side note explains a whole different phenomena, why we find in Mepharshim, we find in Gemara, we find in Kabbalah, that different people are connected to different mitzvahs, meaning we're all obligated to keep all the mitzvahs, so we all supposed to serve Hashem in the same way, meaning the same moral code that he's given us in different ways and so on, but nevertheless, we find in the Gemara this concept of avuch b'mayhav azori tfei, which means that certain people have their pet mitzvahs, have their mitzvahs that sort of they connect to more, and they sort of do more, or get involved in more. Or we have, conversely, we have certain people that know that they are challenged with certain mitzvahs. And we know from the commentaries that if someone has a particular challenge in a particular mitzvah, it might mean that that's the mitzvah that's very important for them, right? So that all these things, and it has to do which soul they ultimately are accessed to, which soul they are connected to, and it's got to do also with which part of Adam HaRishon's body was that soul connected to. That's just a side thing. But that's what it says. There were all 600,000 souls. Now, what happened was Adam HaRishon sinned. Adam and Chava sinned with the first fruits. And what happened at that point was that all 600,000 of those souls got involved and experienced what we call a descent. They all became mixed in with the powers of impurity. So they all now became affected. In other words, all these souls became adversely affected. And from that time on, from the first sin onwards, there began a process of what we call tikkun, a process of rectifying the souls, which happened in a very big way around the time of the giving of the Torah, because the Medrash tells us that when the Torah was given, posku zuhamosan, the impurity of the world was eradicated. However, that was only very temporary because it came back with the Egel Hazov, came back with the golden calf. Ever since the golden calf reenacted and reignited in the world, so to speak, the impurity that came from the original sin of Chet Eitz Hadas, it's still here and we're still working on it, and it won't be fully fixed and fully elevated and fully processed until Mashiach comes, right? So that's the tikkun. The ultimate tikkun, the ultimate rectification is Mashiach. But really, we're all working through the process of elevating and rectifying everything that's in the world, starting with our own neshama. Now, just as a side note, just because it's interesting, when we say that the Adam HaRishon's neshamas, the neshamas that he had, all experienced a descent and they all became lower and they all became connected with the powers of impurity, there were some of those souls that actually, Kabbalah tells us, that actually got completely trapped in the world of Klippa, in the world of which is the other side of Kedusha, so to speak. And in fact, some of them got completely lost and fell off the map, so to speak, which why they're actually not part of the Jewish nation. And part of the rectification of the souls is sometimes rediscovering, not only fixing the neshamas that are already part of the nation, but actually rediscovering and reigniting those neshamas which are somewhere else, are trapped in other things or other people or other experiences, which explains a lot of interesting things. For example, Or HaChaim HaKadosh on Parshas Kisetze, when he talks about the mitzvah in the Torah of the woman of war, right? The Eishes Yifas Torah, the beautiful woman, that if someone goes out to war and he sees a woman, that's a Parshas Kisetze. And the Torah gives permission for the person in war to marry that woman, right? It's a whole process. You've got to take her home and then put her through a thing, and then you still want to marry her. That's a whole one of the mitzvahs, one of the difficult mitzvahs to understand in the Torah, right? Or HaChaim HaKadosh has a fascinating, fascinating explanation in it. Because Rashi tells us that Keneged Yetzahara Dibra Torah, that the reason that there's a mitzvah, that when a soldier goes out to war, he can marry the woman that he captures, that's because it was a concession to human weakness. In other words, the Torah knows that people are weak, and therefore, in such a situation, he's going to end up marrying her anyway, so therefore the Torah gave a way to do it in a permissible way. So if he really wants to marry, he's got to be committed, he's got to be completely committed to her, and so on and so forth. The Rachaim on a deeper level, I mean, not Rashi's obviously pshat, but the Rachaim on a deeper level gives the Kabbalistic view, says the most fascinating thing, he says, who are the people that went to war? People that went to war were actually great tzaddikim. We know from Parsha Shoftim that used to make this whole announcement before the soldiers went out to war that, number one, if you planted a vineyard or built a house or just got married, then you don't have to go. But also the final announcement was, anyone who's Yarev or Rachalevov, anyone who's scared, And the Gemara says, what does it mean scared? Scared to go out to war because they might have done an aver, they might have done something wrong, and therefore they fear that the merit of their mitzvahs won't protect them in war, then they don't go to war. Right? So who are the soldiers left? These are people that are, and this is the people that get involved with the Eishes of Aster. The Rachaim says an unbelievable thing. The Rachaim says that when a soldier goes out to war in the ancient times, right? And he feels attracted to this person, and unstoppable attraction, and it's out of nature. It's completely, it's out of character, so to speak. For the people, says the Rachaim, the Torah gives permission to marry her because what is actually happening, that the reason that attraction happened, that connection happened, was because there's a spark of a neshama that's been trapped in that particular person, and this process of him having an unstoppable attraction to that woman, even though it's completely out of character, is actually a process of, and he has to make sure that he's committed to going through the process to helping that neshama, and therefore the Torah puts him through a whole process, and therefore eventually that results in that marriage. Anyway, there's a lot more wild stuff to come. So this is, right, this is just an interesting thing. Okay, which also explains, other things explains why throughout history, there were people that were unbelievable, impure people, rishoyim, wicked people, right? Who actually eventually turned around, converted, and gave, either they became themselves or they gave birth to incredible tzaddikim, right? Nevuzraddan, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, the Gemara says about one of the people who actually was in a try and capture Yerushalayim before it was actually captured by others. He eventually converted, and he also, I think, one of the great Tanoim, the Amoraim, came from him. Remeir, I think, came from him, if I'm not mistaken. We know the story in Tanakh of Rochav, who married Yehoshua. Who was Rochav? Rochav was the woman who the two spies of Yehoshua stayed by in Tanakh, stayed by when they went to spy out the land the second time, the good spies, right? And they stayed by there, and there's a machloek, is exactly how you interpret the pasukim, but according to one pshat, it's the poshta pshat, is the simple pshat, is that she was an isha zoyna, she was a prostitute, right? She wasn't a very, she ran an inn, and the inn was for dignitaries and you know, big personalities that would come there, but they wouldn't only come there for food. So she was the woman, right? But she helped out the spies, eventually she did tshuva, and she actually married Yehoshua, I'm talking about the Talmud of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Who understood who she really was in essence, and that neshama was captured. That neshama was captured there, and then released, so to speak, and redeemed. And out of Rachav, I think, came seven Nevim, seven prophets, and one prophetess. I forgot. I think it's the number up there. Seven. I think the number seven is correct, right? So that's it. In general, we know that there's a concept, and this has got to do with this whole thing and the process of Adam Rishon. That we know that the Gemara has a famous idea where it talks about someone who converts, and it says Ger Shenisgayer. The convert who converted. The Mefarshim always asks the question, what does that mean? Because normally when you say a child who became an adult, what's the expression in the Talmud? Katan shenisgadel, a minor who became an adult. A slave that was freed, you say, Eved shenishtachrer, a slave that became free. So when someone converts, it should be a non-Jew who converts, right? It should be goy shenisgayer. It doesn't say that, it says a convert who converts. It doesn't make sense, that language, right? So the Mefarshim explained, the reason is because the Gershon is Gair was really always a Gair. In other words, there was always a hidden spark, always a hidden neshama that was already there. And the process of Gair was just was igniting and releasing that neshama to actually reveal who the person really is. Okay, so that's all got to do with the neshamas of Adam Rishon. But back to this concept. So therefore, once Adam Rishon sinned, they began a process of tikkun that the neshamas need to be rectified. In general, we know that things that happen in this world never have a purpose just to remain impure. There's always a purpose that ultimately the whole world should be elevated. When Mashiach comes, it says, "Es ruach hatumo avir min ha'ores." Hashem says, I will remove impurity from the land. In other words, that will be the time where the whole world will be elevated to its completely spiritual state and everything will be rectified. Part of that process of tikkun, one of the ways that we bring about this concept of tikkun is through the Torah and mitzvahs, of course, which also has to do with this idea, as a mere introduction, that neshamas, all these souls, the souls we are taught have 613 components, connected, corresponding to the 613 mitzvahs, right? And therefore, part of the tikkun, part of the rectification of the neshamas, of all the souls that became affected through the chait eitz hadas, through the first sin, is through the mitzvahs of... When we do a mitzvah, every time we do a mitzvah, besides all the other benefits of the mitzvah, divine revelation and so on and so forth. But every time we do a mitzvah or we stay away from something we shouldn't do, which is also a mitzvah, we rectify one part of that neshama, one part of the 613 components of the neshama. Okay. So how does that tikkun work? So therefore like this, there's various ways, and again, I'm going quickly, so I'm just going to sort of rush through this and give you a summary. There's various ways how that tikkun could actually work. Right? So first of all, there's the idea like this. The Arizal says that one reason why neshamas, why souls keep on coming back, is because every neshama has to be elevated completely. And because every neshama has 613 parts, right? The Alter Rebbe brings this in Tanya as well. Therefore, every neshama ultimately has to keep all 613 mitzvahs. Okay? Now, it's an impossibility. A person cannot keep all 613 mitzvahs.
You mean the 600,000 original ones?
Yes. Even the break-offs, right? Every neshama, which is a neshama has to... Yeah, a neshama has 613 parts. And every neshama, and it's the original derivatives, I should say. Not the offshoots because of Gilgal. I'm talking about the offshoots, the original offshoots. Right, have to keep all 630 mitzvahs, which is an impossibility because no one person is it working, Yaakov? Okay. No one person can keep 600 mitzvahs. Why? There's some mitzvahs that are only kept during temple times, some mitzvahs are only kept during our times, some mitzvahs for men, some mitzvahs for women, some mitzvahs for Kohanim, Levim. It's impossible, right? So part of the process of Gilgul is an Hashem didn't do anything wrong. A person come down to this world, do everything right, keep all the mitzvahs, but if it's a new neshama, they haven't fixed everything up yet. Because they've only done the mitzvahs they could do. Therefore, throughout all the ages, since the neshamas started coming down, the neshamas have been coming back into different forms. Now, the neshamas in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the mitzvahs of the Beis HaMikdash, we do not. There's one exception to this concept, because there are three mitzvahs in the Torah that are given to kings. Now, not all the neshamas are coming back as kings, right? But in the Arizal and in Tanya brings it down, that's not a problem, because a king is a representative of everyone anyways. So therefore, when the king kept his mitzvahs, he was sort of moitzi. Everyone was yoitzi with that. So therefore, the king is called Lev Kol Kahal Yisrael. The king is the heart of the nation. And therefore, when the king keeps the mitzvahs, by extension, everyone is keeping those mitzvahs. So that doesn't need to come back. People don't need to come back to keep those mitzvahs, but otherwise they do. So people have to come back as a kohen, as a levi, as a woman, in Golis, out of Golis, in Eretz Yisrael, out of Eretz Yisrael, whatever the case is, in order to keep all of the mitzvahs. That's one particular scenario where there's a Gilgul and the Gilgul comes back. Now, I just want to, before I go on, I just want to highlight something which I think is important to understand, which the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains in one of his essays, that because he was once asked a question like this, we know one of the 13 principles of faith is we believe in we have 13 principles of faith, right? One of them is the last one, in fact, like in the Yigdal song, is we believe in Tchias HaMesim, right? So the famous question was asked, if you believe in Tchias HaMesim, who am I coming back? Who's the person coming back as? Right? Someone who passed away, who are they coming back as? Coming back as the last person they were, the previous person, the first person, right? So the Rebbe explained, it doesn't work like that. Because we are physical people, therefore our frame of reference is always physicality. So when we think of something coming back, it's either in the one person or it's in the other person, right? Gilgul HaNeshamas, the reincarnation of soul, doesn't work like that. The way Gilgul HaNeshamas works is it's like you need to think about it more like a candle. So, for example, if you light a candle from another candle, the first candle is still there, and now both candles are burning. In a similar, not exactly, but in a similar way, the part that comes back is the part of the neshama that needs to be fixed. And when it's like, I suppose the best example, I mean, I'm not a very medical person, but I suppose, you know, when you take off tissue and then the tissue grows, like you take a part of a liver and the liver grows the whole liver, right? That's a medical thing, right? So that's exactly how it works. In other words, part of the neshama is sort of sent down, but both neshamas now exist as souls, and therefore they're both coming back because they both have the whole neshama. The only difference is that the part of the neshama that came back into me, for example, will determine what I need to fix or what my emphasis will be, what my spiritual mitzvahs that I'll be drawn to, so to speak, right? But that doesn't mean that the person I was before, could be in Gan Eden and I could still be here and we both share the same neshama and it's not a problem, right? Just to give you a bit of a perspective how it works. Okay. So one idea of neshamas coming back is just to complete the cycle of all 613 mitzvahs. However, there is a different concept of neshamas coming back, and that's not so much to fulfill a mitzvah which my previous Gilgul couldn't keep, but it's also to fix something that was missing in the previous life, right? So I'll give you a couple of examples. Now, I want to just make an introduction here. Normally, we are taught, and I think very importantly, that we don't understand Hashem's plans for anything, and we certainly, at least simple people, like all of us, don't attempt ever to explain suffering, right? That's just a general principle. We know the question about suffering exists. We normally say it's about emunah. We understand that God has a master plan. He has a broader picture. He does what he does. And we work, rather than working on answering the questions, whenever there's suffering or tragedy, God forbid, we work on strengthening our acceptance. We strengthen our faith, our emunah, which is super rational, right? And accept it. That's why we say Kaddish when people pass away, because we glorify Hashem's name. We accept it. We say Diana Emes. We say Hashem is the true judge. We accept it. We don't know why. We don't need to know why. And that's the way it is. Having said that, right, and that's certainly the way it should be for the most part. Having said that, we do find sometimes in the writings of great tzaddikim that in a very interesting way, and sometimes quite a harsh way, they did explain certain things, and they explained certain things because they were able to see the bigger picture. Right? Now, it's not a lesson for us to start coming up with reasons why things happened, God forbid. Because not always it happens for these reasons. Not always it happens because of tikkun. But sometimes it does. And I'll give you an example. It's brought down in Kabbalah that there was, and this is a fascinating thing. We know that there was a part in history, talking about the Spanish Inquisition, a bit before that, the Crusades and so on. Later on even, and when the whole thing of the Cantonists happened, when the kids under the Tsar were slept away to the army and so on. But there was a part of Jewish history in a later part, not post-Beis HaMikdash, in other words, in Golus, right? Take Spanish Inquisition, for example, where the Jews were tested with threat of conversion, right? That was the big thing. Today we don't have that test, meaning only when people do it, unfortunately, voluntarily. But I'm saying no one's holding a knife to us, no one's burning us, Baruch Hashem. We have freedom of religion, thank God. But there was a time in history where that wasn't the case. And there was terrible tzaris to the point that many, 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 many Yidden gave up their life because of faith in God. They gave up their life not to serve Avodah Zarah, not to serve other gods, not to convert, not to do these things, right? That's fair. And it came with a huge price. It came with a huge price of suffering. It came with a huge price of giving up their life of what we call Mesiras Nefesh. And there were Mekubalim that explained, the Mittler Rebbe brings us down, others bring it down. It's hard to accept and it's hard to understand, but this is what they say. That they say that those neshamas that had to do that were a gilgul of neshamas of the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, what's that got to do with the first Beis HaMikdash? In the first temple, we know, we find a very, almost like an oxymoron, a contradiction like that happens in the first Beis HaMikdash. On the one hand, we always get told, if you learn Hasidus, if you learn Kabbalah, you'll get told that the neshamas of the first Beis HaMikdash were very lofty souls, right? Very, very high souls. And it's explained in many, many different ways. They belong to a different spiritual world. They were very, very high neshamas, very high madrega, very high level, and so on and so forth. Yet we find a phenomenon that took place, if you look in Tanakh, that it was crazy in the first Beis HaMikdash. There was this incredible Yetzirah for paganism, for idol worship. Almost in an irrational way, right? Which it says that afterwards, between the first and the second Beis HaMikdash, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, it's a long story, I'll just give you the quick synopsis of it, daven to Hashem, and essentially the Yetzirah, the pull towards pagan worship, idol worship, was taken away. It might have been substituted with other Yetziraras, other temptations for other types of idol worships, more symbolic ones, but that was taken away. Now we know in Jewish thought, in Jewish writings, in the Chumash and Halacha, Avodah Zarah is one of the three cardinal sins. It's a terrible thing, right? So, but in the Beis HaMikdash, there were people who were Torah scholars, who had this lofty souls, and yet they got trapped in this Avodah Zarah. Some kings were even like that. There were great tzaddikim, and there were those that served Avodah Zarah. Just to give you an example of this, King Manasseh, one of the kings of the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, was a terrible pagan worshiper, to the point that there's even a discussion in the Gemara if he is one of the people who don't have a chayla, don't have a portion in the world to come. We say, Kol Yisrael Yesh Chayla, but everyone has a portion in the world to come. A few exceptions. Maybe Manasseh doesn't have, right? And there's a whole discussion in the Gemara, and then there was another discussion that had to do with a very complex issue of halacha, to do with how you cut bread for a meal and a bracha and so on and so forth. It's called Hilchos Petzias Sapas. And I'm not mistaken, I think it was Abaya, one of the great Amoraim, goes to sleep and he has a dream. And in that dream, Menashe comes to him. Menashe, who had been the subject of the discussion in the Beis HaMedrash about if he's going to have a chalik of the Olam HaBo or not, right? Menashe comes to him and he solves the sugya for him. He solves the complex Talmud halachic for him. And in his dream, Abaya looks at Menashe and says, whoa, you? Such a Talmud Chacham? So, what was with you? Like, so why did you serve Avodah Zarah if you're such a big Talmud Chacham, right? Such a Torah scholar and you served Avodah Zarah? So the Gemara says that Menashe told him that I guarantee you that if you, Abaya, if you would have lived in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, you would pick up your long coat to run faster to serve Avodah Zarah. That's how big the temptation was. Some overcame the temptation, some didn't. So the Mekubalim say that those neshamas that then who came back, and the tikkun for not doing that, the tikkun for serving Avodah Zarah in the first Beis HaMikdash, those neshamas had to come back to this world, they had to be tested again, and they had to overcome that temptation to the point of suffering, sometimes giving up their lives, and that was the tikkun for those souls who came back, who were in the first Beis HaMikdash. Again, hard thing to understand, but this is what they say. Yeah. Different form of Edazar, it was conversion, Christianity, whatever it was. Yeah? But the idea of giving up your life for Amunah, for faith in Hashem. Okay. I'll tell you an interesting little story of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was once walking in the street. The Baal Shem Tov also was a great Kabbalist. The Baal Shem Tov had a bit of an insight in what's happening in the higher world. We know many, many stories about that. But one time the Baal Shem Tov was walking and he saw two people coming out of a Beis Din. And they just had a litigation. And one of them was very, very upset. So he says, why are you upset? He says, because I've just come out of Beis Din. Let me tell you the story. The story is like this. I was taken to court. I was taken to a Beis Din because the plaintiff said that I owe him money. Right? A nice size of money. And I know I do not owe him that money. Anyway, he's a bit of a con man, so he concocted a whole case. He had no complaints in the Beis Din, so the Beis Din did their job. They listened to what they were supposed to listen to. They took all the evidence that was available to them in a logical human way. They paskin the shaila. And they're paskin that I owe him the money. So I'm very, very bothered. How could it be that a din Torah should result? And he had no problems. He had no problem with how a din Torah worked. It was not a problem. It was 100% down the line. But he says, I know I don't owe him the money. So it bothers me. How could HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow such a thing to happen where I have to pay money that I know I don't owe? I'm going to do it because I'm a frum Jew and that's what they paskin. That was the thing. That's the halacha. And of course I'm going to listen. I'm going to do it, right? But it bothers me. So the Baal Shem Tov looked at him and he told him a whole story, and the essence of the story was that you and him are not the first time you're here. You were here in a previous life. You owed him money you didn't pay, and part of the decision was, you know, Shem has to come back and fix it up. So you came back, and you should know it's a big simcha today. You ended up paying money you don't owe him, but you should know the big simcha today by doing that and keeping the halacha and listening to what they paskin and said and paying the money even though you don't owe it. You have now created a tikkun for your neshama. That you can go say l'chaim. It's a very, very big simcha. Okay. So those are just some of the ideas of how our tikkun works. Right. There's another kind of thing. Again, I promised you some wild stuff today. I don't claim to understand this myself, but the Arizal says that sometimes there's a gilgul, sometimes a reincarnation, because every neshama, people talk about soulmates, but actually, and there's another discussion itself. The Arizal says that not everyone ends up marrying their soulmate. Do you know that? Some people do, some people don't. It's a big schus. It's apparently a schus to be able to marry your real soulmate, right? So in other words, every male neshama has a connection to a female neshama, and not always that's the marriage. For whatever reason. And sometimes a neshama has a schus to be able to come back to this world in order to end up marrying their soulmate. So sometimes it didn't happen the first time, it happens the second time around. I don't understand what that means. I'm just sharing it with you. Now, we know that neshamas don't only come back into people. Okay, this is an interesting thing. Neshamas, who sometimes need a particular tikkun, come back into... Well, they could come into other things, but they could come into animals. Okay? Now, okay? And the tikkun comes by using what they were sent into for a good purpose, right? A very tragic story about Gilgul was that Badish Shavarov once saw a person going into a bar and drinking vodka without making a bracha. And he said, you missed out on an opportunity. There was a neshama waiting there for you to rectify and you didn't do it. Okay. That's a sad part of the story. But it is brought down in Sfarim that sometimes people come down for a tikkun because they actually were tzaddikim. But they still, because the neshamas need to go sometimes through a process of back and forth to get a proper polish, to get a proper tikkun. So sometimes there's just something that still needs to be fixed, nothing wrong, nothing, no transgression, no real lack, but they have to be a little bit elevated. So one of the animals in this world that are represent greater spirituality is fish. Okay? So it says that the fish we eat on Shabbos, I'm not going to put anyone off here from eating fish on Shabbos from now on, but the fish that we eat on Shabbos, particularly by Shalashudas, but some people have a very strong minig of Shalashudas, is always a toned down, like a sort of a downgraded meal, but it's always got fish. Some people are very makrit to eat fish by Shalashudas, and generally, it says in Shulchan Aruch that eating fish on Shabbos is an important thing to do, right? I mean, the zmiris that we sing Shabbos has in it basar of a dog and meat and fish, but actually fish is even more important than meat on Shabbos. And it's brought down in Kabbalah that sometimes dafka souls of tzaddikim come back in a gilgul in fish, and that's used l'kavod Shabbos, when it's used in honor of Shabbos, that's the concept of tikkun. Okay. So next time you eat gefilte fish, make a proper bracha, have in mind to eat it l'kavod Shabbos, and so on. So that's part one. Let me quickly go through part two. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what the Arizal says and what Mekubalim say of Gilgulim that we do know. Like I say, for the most part, 99.9% of the time, we don't know who's a Gilgul of who, and not that it makes that much difference. So I'll give you two examples if we have time. So there's a concept of that goes like this. That, you know, in the very beginning of creation, there was Cain and Hevel. Okay. Cain kills Hevel. It was a transgression, a very bad transgression. Big machloikus, jealousy, and so on. Murder, first politics. And that's it. Now, that was an act that happened. This is just an example of what Kabbalah tells us. It doesn't just go away. It needs to, Cain and Hevel had souls. Cain's soul went through a real problem, a real bad experience, a real negative experience. That soul has to be fixed. So it happens through Gilgal. And the way the Kabbalah explains it is as follows. Hevel came back first in his brother that was born after him called Shase, right? And then came back afterwards as Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was a Gilgal of Shase, who was a Gilgal of Hevel. Okay, and I didn't give a handout today, but listen to this carefully. The word Moshe is an acronym for Moshe, Shase, and Hevel. Got that? Okay. Now, when it comes to Cain, when Hashem was very upset with Cain for murdering his brother, Cain said, like, now everyone's going to kill me, they're going to be upset with me. Hashem promised him that he will live for 7 generations. And the pasuk says, Kishivasayim yukam Cain. For 7 generations, Cain will exist. The word is Yukam Yud Kuf Mem. Because we are told that Cain's neshama, or different parts of Cain's neshama, came back in a Gilgul in 3 different people, who all had to go through a tikkun through Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, who was Hevel, was coming back to fix up. That's why, to fix up Cain, right? So what's Yakum Yud Kuf Mem? Is Yisroi. Yisroi was one Gilgul of Cain. Koirach, Mitzri, the Egyptian that Moshe Rabbeinu actually killed. The Mitzri in Mitzrayim, that Moshe Rabbeinu came up and he saw the Mitzri hitting the Jew, and he killed him. All of these 3 people we know had a very, very strong experience with Moshe Rabbeinu, correct? So Moshe Rabbeinu kills the Mitzri, Yisrael becomes his father-in-law, he has an interaction with Yisrael, and then of course Koirach led a whole rebellion against Moshe Rabbeinu, and eventually Koirach was swallowed up into the ground. So very, very briefly, there's a long, long, long arichos in this, but how does it work? It works like this, that one of the averus, one of the wrongdoings of Korach, of course, of Cain was murder. So when Moshe Rabbeinu killed that Mitzri, that was a tikkun for the murder that he had experienced against Hevel. So Hevel killed the Mitzri, who was beating up the Jew. That was a tikkun for the murder case that Cain had killed Hevel. Now comes the second one. That's the interesting thing. So Yisroi, what's the story with Yisroi? So again, I promised you wild stuff. So we know that the Gemara asked a question, Chazal asked a question. Adam and Chava, right, were created, and they had two sons, Cain and Hevel. That's very nice. How did the world continue? How did the world populate? So we know a famous thing. The Chazal tells us that Olam Chesed Yibone. The world is built on a certain type of kindness. Where do we find the word Chesed mentioned in the Torah later on? This is interesting. We find the word Chesed, apart from kindness and all that, we find the word Chesed by incest in Parshas Achrei Mo'es and Gedoshi. Right? So we know that actually there was a permitted thing originally from the very, very first time that Cain was created with one twin, Hevel was created with two twins, and that's how the world began. Right? Chazal tell us that what happened was part of what Cain wanted is Cain wanted the second twin. He was jealous of the second twin. Hevel had two twins, Cain had one twin. Right? That's why he killed Hevel. Yeah? And took the other twin. Well, Cain and Hevel were born separately. It doesn't say they were twins. So Hevel was a triplet, and Cain was a twin, correct. Correct, right? That twin that was the subject of Cain's jealousy was a Gilgul into Tzipora, the wife of Moshe Rabbeinu, the daughter of Yisrael. So Moshe, that's what Kabbalah says. So when Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Midian, and he gets Yisrael to give him Tzipora, that was Cain giving back the twin to Hevel. And that was a tikkun of that part of the Aver. And then finally there was Korach, and Korach was machloikus, which was jealousy, which had to do with the whole thing of Cain. But the problem was that one of the things that happened during the whole murder, this is one way it's explained, one of the things that happened during the murder of Cain and Hevel is that the earth did something wrong. The earth, until Hashem came to Cain and said, "Aye, Hevel Achicha, where's Hevel your brother?" And he said, "I'm my brother's keeper," right? The famous thing. Where was Hevel? Hevel had been swallowed up by the earth. Cain had buried Hevel in the earth. And what the earth did then was the earth covered up the murder. Right? Which was sort of a stain on the earth. That's what some of the Kabbalim explained it. Therefore, the tikkun of that was that Korach got swallowed up by the earth, and when Korach was swallowed by the earth and was public, and everyone saw it, and that was a confirmation of the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu, was the Gilgal of Hevel. That was the tikkun for the earth covering up the murder of Hevel, and then the whole thing became fixed. That's one of the examples in Kabbalah, many, many examples. The Kabbalah that we see the answer to. I'll give you another one that comes from Rimi Pano, which is this is really wild. I just bought a sefer recently. I gave the shiur a number of years ago, but then I just recently bought a sefer all about Gilgulim. It's a fascinating topic. So I saw there about Esther and Achashverosh and Vashti, a very, very fascinating thing. I'll just mention it very, very, very briefly. It's a Rimi Pano, who's a 16th century Makubal. There's a story, a famous story, it's even been made into kids' books, right? That has to do with someone, a great chassid, a pious person who had a cow. And the halacha is that the cow, an animal, can't work on Shabbos either. Jewish animals are not allowed to work on Shabbos, you know that, right? So if you own an animal, I can't put my cow on a time switch to do a plowing in the field. Or I can't get a non-Jew to do plowing in the field because my animal also has to keep Shabbos, right? So this chassid had a cow. The kids know the story. It's like it's printed in the kids' books today. And then he sold the cow. Sold the cow to a non-Jew. A very, very good cow. Great working cow. Fantastic, strong cow. And then 7 days later, the non-Jew comes back and says to the guy, "You sold me a lemon." "But what kind of cow is this?" He says, "Why? 6 days, he worked really well. Come Shabbos morning, cow won't move." Right? Cow refuses to move. So this chassid, I've forgotten who it was, this great tzaddik, he said, "Come, I'll fix it for you." He goes over to the cow. He whispers in the cow's ears, "You can now work on Shabbos because you don't belong to me anymore." And the next Shabbos, he started to work. So the guy ran back to this guy and he says, "What was that all about?" So explain to him the story. So the owner of the new owner of the cow said, "If that's so holy, this is what the Torah is all about, that's unbelievable." And he went and he converted and became a very big tzaddik. And the cow stopped working again because now he became Jewish. Okay. So with a very lengthy explanation, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. Actually, I just read it mamash yesterday, and I have to dish myself. It's a whole chapter in this book where it talks about that Ahasuerus also had a spark of Kedusha in him. Going back to what I said in the beginning, that sometimes sparks of Kedusha take a while until they become elevated. Ahasuerus married Vashti. We know that Vashti, the Medrash tells us, the Gemara tells us actually, that Vashti, one of her great wrongdoings was that she used to take, it's a famous thing, right? She used to take Jewish maidens and employ them as servants in the house of the king and force them to work on Shabbos, right? And Ahasuerus allowed this to happen. So according to Rimi Pana, Vashti came back as a gigol in that cow, who was then hurt, that tikkun of her neshama happened, that the cow refused to work on Shabbos, even when it was sold to the non-Jew. That was like a tikkun for the fact that she made the Jewish maidens work on Shabbos. And that owner, the new owner of the cow, was Ahasuerus, and he was Mesakin, he released the spark that was originally in Ahasuerus, and he became Jewish and became a big tzaddik, and that was a tikkun for Ahasuerus' neshama.
Non-Jewish people have a neshama?
Yes, that's a very, no, so first of all, it depends who we said. A lot of times people convert is because they have a Jewish neshama, which was just dormant, waiting to be released, because that was part of Adam Arishan's thing, right? Having said that, we do find, particularly before the Torah was given, that we do find Gilgul, like for example, Kai and Evel, we do find Gilgul people who weren't Jewish. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but it works somehow as well. No, it looks like she also has some spark of neshama that needed to be fixed, and that was fixed to the fact that that cow wouldn't work on Shabbos, because that spark came back in the cow. Okay, that's part two. That's just two examples. There's lots and lots of examples of the stuff of where we know. The Arizal talked a lot about Gilgulim, who was the Gilgul of who, and why they came back in this way and that way, and what the tikkun was, and so on and so forth. But that's just two examples. But I want to just finish with an important idea. What's the relevance of all this besides a nice lecture on the summer learning program? That's interesting, but I hope, right? What's the relevance of it? Because most of us don't know who we were before, and it doesn't make that much of a difference. We are born, we come, we live as Yidden, we have a Shulchan Aruch, we have a Torah. The Torah tells us what to do. We do it, right? We keep the mitzvahs to the best of our ability. If we feel particularly drawn to one mitzvah, we get involved. Some people are drawn to Torah learning more than everyone has learned Torah, but some people have learned more. Some people give more tzedakah, and that's fine. Some people have struggles with certain mitzvahs, so therefore we know that's a very, very important mitzvah. Therefore we try and overcome that temptation, and we try and work on that mitzvah that we find particular challenge with, because we know that's a really important mitzvah for us. That's all good. Why is it relevant to know that we were here before, we weren't here before, the Gilgul? Why is it a relevant concept? So I'll just share with you a famous idea, but I think a very important idea. An idea that the Lubavitcher Rebbe explains on the Pesach Haggadah. I don't want to scare anyone, but Pesach is coming in a few months, you know, so after Purim. So the Pesach Haggadah. What's the Pesach Haggadah? The famous, famous idea that Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah said that he is like 70 years and he couldn't convince everyone to say the third parak of Shema, the third chapter of Shema, to mention the going out of Egypt at night, until Ben Zoyma helped him out, and the Pasuk, and so on and so forth. So we know what's the famous idea. It's based on the Gemara. What's the famous idea that Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah says, I am like 70 years old, which means I'm not 70 years old. The Gemara says he was appointed to be the head of the Sanhedrin when he was 18, right? But how did it happen? It happened because they wanted to, it was a whole thing. They removed Rabbi Gamliel for a whole story. Then they decided to appoint Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, who was the most qualified candidate to be in the Sanhedrin, but he had one problem, and that was young. He was too young. He was only 18. Consulted with his wife, and then he said, yes. No, anyway, the bottom line was that through the night, God performed a miracle, and he grew gray hair, and he looked sagely when he woke up in the morning. He looked like he was 70 years old, so therefore he fitted the post, so they appointed him. So he says, you know, it's an amazing thing. I'm like 70 years old, and I still can't convince them. But if you learn the Gemara, what do you mean you're like 70 years old? But you're not 70 years old. You're an 18-year-old young man. Of course you couldn't convince them. Just because overnight you started to look like you were 70, wasn't it? So what's the amazement, right? If a person is really 70 and a sage of 70 and he can't convince his colleagues, understand, I've got such life experience and I still can't convince them. But he knew he wasn't 70, so what's he complaining about? The answer is because in Kabbalah it is written that Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah was a Gilgul of Shmuel Hanavi. Shmuel Hanavi was a great tzaddik. Shmuel Hanavi was a tzaddik, but he died young. He died at 52. Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah continued on Shmuel Hanavi, so when he was 18, he was taka 70. Spiritually, he was taka 70 years old. He just didn't look it. Right? What Hashem did, he made him overnight look like 70 to match his real identity, his real strength. Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, of course, knew this. He knew he didn't just wake up in the morning looking like 70 because it's a sort of a show. He knew that Hashem made him look like 70 to match his real essence, right? So he says, I'm taka like 70. I have the spiritual strength of 70. I'm really like 70. Right? So I don't understand why I can't convince my colleagues. So the Rebbe says an interesting thing. The Rebbe says that means, that's an amazing lesson. That means, which we have to qualify, but it means like this. It means most of us are all Gilgulim, which means we need to understand that we have greater strength than we think we do. Because we're not operating on, sometimes when we think it's too hard and it's hard to overcome a spiritual challenge and spiritual weakness and so on and so forth, it's hard to learn, it's hard to daven, it's hard to do a mitzvah, whatever the case is, we need to know it's hard to be nice to other people, whatever the area of challenge is, we need to know that we have much greater strength than we think. We've got years of experience, especially us, we've been, you know, we've been going through this, is already the sixth millennia, right? So we've got years and years of strength behind us. Yeah, we need to know that. We need to have, just like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was complaining, and he said, look, I'm not 18, I'm much older than 18. We too, we're much older than whatever age we are, we're much, much older than that, and we much have much more strength than that, and therefore we should be able to understand the great potential and the great strength that we really have. The only problem with that is, as the Rebbe points out, there's a problem with that argument. That's good news for some, but bad news for others. For Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, that was great news, because his Gilgul was Shmuel HaNavi, okay? If you're piggybacking on Shmuel HaNavi's strength, right? If your 18 years is on top of Shmuel HaNavi's 52 years, that's great news. What happens? I don't know who my previous guy was. Maybe he was a gangster. I don't know. Right? So maybe I don't want to be as old as the previous one, if you know what I'm saying. Maybe I want to be fresh, right? So why is that good news for everyone? So he says a very, very important idea. Every person throughout their life does good. There's no person that does only bad. Every person does some good. I mean, maybe there's some exceptions, but I'm saying generally speaking, right? Generally speaking, every person goes through life. You know, there's a quick little story just to prove the point. You know, the Baditshev Rebbe, Rabbi Yitzchak Baditshev, would always say only good things about people, right? Famous thing. So he once met not a nice person. He read a person in the street, one of the people of Baditshev, who was known not to be, to say he wasn't particularly religious was an understatement. In other words, he was a guy that didn't do anything right. So he says to Baditshev Rebbe one day, he says, Rebbe, I got a question for you. Your Torah is not true. He said, you know, he says, and I read in the Shema that from Asati Hashem is going to send us rain. But if you don't do the right thing and you go astray from Hashem and you don't serve Hashem and you go after foreign gods, Hashem is not going to give you rain. He won't give you abundance. He won't give you parnasa. Look at me. I went astray and nothing happened to me. So this Rav turns around and says to him, how do you know this? But it says that in the Shema. He says, well, I mean, I've read Shema before. He says, you're wondering why Hashem gave you such blessing? You know, one time reading Shema, you know what kind of mitzvah it is? So that's why you have mitzvahs, right? I'm just saying that most people have done more than just read Shema once, but everyone has good. We have a principle that goes like this. This principle needs more explanation, but this is the principle, the foundational principle. The principle is like this, that good is eternal. Bad has no real reality. Bad is a superficial stain which gets removed after a person passes away. So therefore, when I say that, if we say that we are all Gilgulim, which we are, we're all Gilgulim, we've all been here before, we take with us the good of whoever we were before, but we don't take with the baggles. We don't take the baggage. The baggage gets cleansed after a person passes away. There's a journey of the soul, and that baggage gets cleansed. The good is eternal. The good can never be undone. So therefore, even though Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had a particular dose of that, and he was particularly special and lucky because he was a soul that was a special soul, but he also was a Gilgul of Shmuel HaNavi, and therefore he carried with him the strength of Shmuel HaNavi, but the same applies to all of us. So that knowing the concept of Gilgul has a relevance. Because the concept of Gilgul means one of the lessons of Gilgul is that we're not doing it fresh. We're not doing it for the first time. We actually have tremendous strength behind us. Maybe the person behind us also had some negative baggage. That's long gone. That's being cleansed. That's not eternal. The good is eternal. So whatever good happened in the previous generation, that's a good that we start off with. And that's a strength and a foundation that we start off with. And it gives us the additional power to be able to serve Hashem properly and to do the right thing. So that's just a couple of thoughts on the concept of Gilgul. And I hope you found it interesting. All right. Have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow.